I sometimes have this sense of cosmic overwhelm when I'm trying to figure out the kinds of things we've been talking about. And then you look at the philosophers and so on, and you know we were used in Beyond Belief, that amazing painting of Anselm Kiefer's, which is a reference to Kant's line about the, you know, the starry heavens above me and the moral law within me. I mean, quite clear Kantian position. And then you look at somebody like Spinoza, and you know that he's talking about a deterministic universe. Deterministic universe doesn't have any free will in it, so it doesn't have any. So where does the agency thing come in? And then these big words that my, you know, I'm at the Salk Institute. Francis Crick used to be there. Consciousness. I mean, these are just huge.
Are you familiar with the studies by Libet?
Ben Libet, yes. In fact, in Francis's office at the house, he has a number of things left on his old whiteboard, which are still there, and one of them was Ben Libet's stuff.
Yeah. So I think that's an interesting starting place to talk about agency.
All right. Why don't you set the scene with
So the study from Libet wanted to see the extent to which neurological activity was commensurate with conscious awareness of decision making, right? So he was looking for particular electrical impulses from the brain and to see when those impulses started firing. So when did neurons start firing from when you made a decision? So he'd say, okay, and sort of a rough description of the study, which blends together some of the other studies, is to say, think about pushing this button, and the moment at which you become consciously aware of it, go ahead and record it. Or, an alternate version of the same study is, you watch a clock, and the moment at which you decide that you want to stop the clock, record that moment down so that we can have a way to know exactly the second at which you became consciously aware. So this presupposes an idea of conscious awareness being about agency, right? And the study, what was interesting about it was that
with the freedom of will followed by an action.
Well, so the study found that there was neurological activity that preceded conscious awareness of making a decision. And so many people have made a lot of these studies to say, look, when you become consciously aware of your decision, the decision has already been made because this neurological activity precedes it. And to be clear, it's something like 4 milliseconds precedes the actual conscious awareness of the decision, and there's a lot of different ways that you could explain that neurological activity. But people say, look, because causal activity happens before conscious awareness, there's no sense at which we could say the agency drove the decision. Something else causally happened which made you consciously aware of a decision that was already made. And I think there's a lot of problems with that interpretation of it, but it raises for me a distinction between freedom of choice versus freedom of action. Freedom of choice would be the ability to choose some particular outcome, and freedom of action would be the ability to choose to act and interact with the world. And for many people, if you can show that there are predispositions, constraints on choices. So your desires, your predispositions can be explained in part by the environment that you were grown in, that you grew up in, whether or not you were exposed to education early, whether or not you had two parents or one parent, what food you were fed as a child, along with your genetic and neurological predispositions. They would say your choices are constrained, so you are not free. And yet we see people making different choices to act in different ways with quite similar constraints. I think it's right to say we all operate with many constraints on our behavior, and the sense in which I use agency is to say, can you identify with the actions and the way in which you interact with the world? So if I raise my hand, do I identify with that and say that was my action? If I drive my car, do I identify with that and say that's my action? And that's the sense in which I use agency, which is the ability to drive action in the world.
All right, so if you ask somebody like my colleague Ramachandran, he would say, I think this is, you're saying something not dissimilar, that what you have in fact is free won't. And there's an area of free won't. I was just looking
at. No, free won't I would put still in the choice, because it's, so there was this whole theory in philosophy about the principle of alternative possibilities, the ability to act otherwise. If we can show that you had no ability to choose otherwise, then people said you can't be held morally responsible. And Harry Frankfurt, I think, did a very nice job of destroying that as a sound theory. So he showed even when there's no alternative possibility. So take a person who has been programmed to shoot another person, okay? So somehow we've wired their brain, we've made it such that they're going to shoot another person. And they desire shooting that other person. Okay, so there's two pathways in which it could happen. One is that the neurological trigger control drives them to act. The other is that they wish for an outcome, which is they desire to shoot the person, and they do in fact shoot the person. Under either scenario, the only possible outcome is that the person will be shot, right? There is no alternative possibility. You are either programmed or you're going to enact it. One way or another, it's going to come about because there's a fail-safe mechanism. People said, if there's no alternative possibility, if there's no alternative outcome, then you can't be held morally responsible. And yet, if he chose to do so via the pathway of wanting, desiring the outcome and effectuating that outcome, even though there was no other possible outcome, we would still say that person is a morally responsible agent. So, you know, this is not quite a free won't theory. It is building on that idea, which is even when there's no alternative possibility, if you choose to act consistent with your desires and identify with that action, we can say that you are a morally responsible agent, and that might be a sufficient theory for legal responsibility as well.
Why don't you also just discuss one of the conversations that was had at the meeting, which was about the whole notion of locked-in syndrome, Stephen Laurie's work and other people.
Yes.
And you came up with a little spin on that in terms of inserting a robot into the proceedings.
So I wrote a piece in the Stanford Technology Law Review where I start to spell out these ideas of freedom of action versus freedom of choice. And I build on showing that neuroscience doesn't just point us inevitably in one direction. So many of the early uses of neuroscience and philosophy of free will was to say, look at Libet's work. Libet's work shows us that, from a neuroscientific basis, people don't have free will. And I think locked-in syndrome, which is being worked on through brain-machine interface, is a nice example from neuroscience that supports an alternative view, which is this idea of freedom of action. So the example that I came up with was this, which is a true possibility right now. So suppose a person has locked-in syndrome and they're unable to communicate.
Let's just unpack locked-in syndrome, this whole notion.
Sorry, I was about to, which is to say a person who has locked-in syndrome is unable to communicate with the external world. So they're essentially locked into a body because they're paralyzed. They don't have control over their physical aspects of their body. And yet they are fully aware of their surroundings, understand, comprehend, and process what's happening. And one way in which they were able to communicate before neuroscientific evidence was through eye blink. So there was a whole, there was a whole kind of conversation and alphabet that was developed through eye blinks. That's quite cumbersome, of course, and quite difficult. And it was only much later that people realized that that was a possibility for interaction and for conversation.
And there was also distinctions being made between persistent vegetative state and this sort of other.
Yeah, so a persistent vegetative state was people who were literally not communicating. They're not even doing the eye blinks. There is no external cue of responsiveness whatsoever. Whereas with somebody with locked-in syndrome, there appears to be some interaction with their eyes. So generally, they have control over their eyes and their ability to blink their eyes versus wink their eyes, right? So they're, that's one distinction that's been drawn in this area is naturally we blink, but we might intentionally wink. And so they were intentionally winking their eye in a way that would allow them to communicate with other people. So there are new technologies that are being developed called brain-machine interface, where you can take somebody, and this, of course, doesn't just have to be with somebody with locked-in syndrome, but this is one of the wonderful uses of it, is you fit them with a cap, an EEG cap, which reads the electrical impulses from their brain, and they're able to then hook that cap up to something like a computer or a wheelchair or other external devices, which allows them to drive those devices based on their intention. So it might be something as simple as thinking up, down, left, right, the person with locked-in syndrome, and that allows them to select letters on a screen to spell out and communicate with people, to type an email, and even to drive equipment like go forward, go backwards, go left, go right in a wheelchair. So that's all a long wind-up to explain the scenario that I wish to present, which was, suppose that a person with locked-in syndrome is fully connected to devices, right? So they're hooked up to a computer, they're hooked up to robotic arms, robotic legs, and they're able to drive those things with their thoughts, right, with their intentionality. And that person thinks, I wish to pick up a gun and pull the trigger and shoot the person who is standing in front of me. And we're able to translate all of that because it's actually going into a computer before it actually gets to the robotic arm and pulls the trigger. And suppose that person is unaware that there's a override to the system, right? Which says if there's some violent act that's going to happen as a result of this machine, then the computer prevents it from happening. So the person with locked-in syndrome who's hooked up to the machine says, I wish to, you know, pick up the gun, pull the trigger. We can see that in the computer. Yeah. It doesn't actually happen in the real world. Is that a morally responsible act, right? Can we hold that person legally responsible? Because now we have the full intentionality. They simply aren't able to effectuate it because we have some computer override to the system. And it helps us understand the difference between freedom of choice and freedom of action, right? There is some external constraint on their ability to act, and yet they are trying to drive action. And then they have all these predispositions and desires and hopes that influence their choice to act. And, you know, I think we might be able to say in that case that that is a morally responsible agent. They have done everything up until the point of pulling the trigger through no choice of their own, they were unable to pull the trigger. But it's a nice example of using neuroscientific evidence to try to break apart action versus choice, but also to present a rather difficult question for people of when we're talking about legal responsibility, do we really care about whether or not the harm has come about in the world? Or are we really trying to assign blame and responsibility for the choices that people make?
Yeah, so I mean, I assume that despite all the impedimenta and all the science and the technology and so on, most people would look at that and said, "Whoa, that was attempted murder."
Right. So I mean, you could say the easy answer is it's attempted murder, and you know, and we could look at the world and say, "Look, there are people who try to pull the trigger of a gun, but because they've been set up by you know believing that the gun is loaded, but it in fact is not, they've done every last step to make that happen." But they have done some act in the real world, right? So the person who commits attempted murder, they've actually physically interacted with the world in a way that is a step shy of what we would say is actually murder because they haven't killed a person, but they've taken actions in the world that show their mental state. And this example is a nice one because all we have is mental state. Right, there is no action that has actually happened. And so to say that that's attempted murder when it's all just something happening in your mind and in your brain is a little bit disingenuous because it doesn't actually present the same analogy. This person has done nothing but think about doing something. And do we think that that person really could be held guilty of attempted murder when all they've done is think about it as opposed to having any real world
action?
When
they patently could never have accomplished it.
Right.
Because of their... quasi-vegetative state.
Right, they're not vegetative, they're actually...
Right, they're
different.
Minimally yeah. conscious.
Well, actually, they're fully conscious. I mean, you know, they are fully conscious, they're simply unable to express their consciousness to the world.
Okay, so I should be careful here, because these are two terms of our persistent vegetative state and minimally conscious PVC.
Yes.
Those are not...
Difficult words.
Yes.
But words that don't apply to locked-in syndrome.
Okay, right, got it. Oh, well, as I said, being a judge is a tricky job, it seems to me. The thing I was referring to, by the way, was some research at UCL by Patrick Haggard some years ago
dealing about free won't
with a dorsal frontal medial cortex. Yeah.
No, I mean, so
again,
those were studies that built on
Libet. Impulse control and so on. These are all immensely interesting areas. I mean, what if you have a better impulse control, a worse impulse control? I mean, what's the responsibility issue there and so on? Just all very tricky, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, that's all the kind of evidence that we're seeing in the courtroom and that people are writing about and thinking about, you know, now that we start to better understand different levels of predispositions and different levels of effect and constraints on behavior, do we need to deal with each person unique to their constraints and predispositions, or do we recognize that every person operates with constraints and predispositions and have a uniform set of rules for people to abide by?
Yeah. This is a little book by the late Sir Peter Medawar, by the way. It's called Advice to a Young Scientist, which I'm going to ask you something about later. I ask everybody what their advice to a young scientist would be. But one of the things that he writes about in here is that he did an essay once about Francis Bacon and the New Atlantis, of course, which could be viewed as a utopian, obviously a utopian novel, but it could it's construed by some people as an example of scientific messianism.
Okay.
And
or essentialism.
Medawar, well, it's not clear to me whether you were talking about scientific essentialism, it was the same as scientism, which is a term of abuse. But let's go back to that in a sense. Scientific messianism. Medawar is making the point that no, he does not endorse that at all. What he's into is not these sort of grand Arcadian initiatives, but scientific meliorism. And you'll know that it's on my the Science Network's card. We talk about a place for scientific meliorists. The idea being a place where you can use science to transform things for the better, not grand, ultimate, so on. But so that seems to me to connote the whole notion of the law working in a pragmatic, meliorist sense. In contradistinction to these grand philosophical view from 30,000 feet abstracts, which can get messianic if we're not too careful. Is that kind of not a similar point to the one you were making?
Well, it's the view of law being a consequentialist instrument. So there is a different function of law than there is for moral philosophy, and we have to decide what that function is. And that function could be something as simple as trying to ameliorate different societal woes, right? So we need to have property regimes in order to ensure that, people feel secure in their homes and in their personhood. And we need to have criminal law regimes in order to have a set of or code of conduct that people follow and to have realistic ways for the government to be able to step in when, social violence is done or when, rules are broken in order to have an effective and functioning society. That's a slightly different view than the, kind of 10,000 foot view, which is what we're really trying to do is put into legal code what our moral and normative thoughts are. And I'd say, especially in criminal law, that's where we see the greatest overlap with normative and moral decision making. But there are areas of criminal law that are not about moral responsibility and moral blameworthiness. There are areas where it is simply the most efficient and effective thing for a functioning society to have certain behavior that we find to be off limits. To understand that there's a different function of the two areas is an important one. And to see where it overlaps and where it doesn't is important as well.
Did you mean the same thing by scientific essentialism as scientism?
What do you mean by scientism?
Scientism is the term of abuse version where it's being used in this sort of messianic kind of way rather than in a...
I mean, I suppose that they are similar in a sense, which is to privilege science and to treat it as, the truth, the objective truth of society. It is a truth. It is one aspect of decision making. It is one aspect of society. But it is not all there is. There is more than just scientific answers, and science doesn't answer for us difficult questions. So I mean by scientific essentialism the idea that science has all the answers for us and we simply have to access it in order to, find the truth of the universe. And I say that in a way which is, I suppose, judgmental, which is that I don't believe that science can answer for us every difficult question that we have to ask in society.
I was just thinking that the truth is such a... that's probably for a conversation for another day. I was just thinking about there's this wonderful little book by Simon Blackburn on truth, and there's also this collection of essays.
Yeah. Right, I mean, truth and meaning and
Williams
all of that.
Williams on truth.
Yes.
One is almost driven to the Wikipedia entry on truthiness from Stephen Colbert relief.
I mean, that's a rich and difficult conversation that, of course, is an entire area of scholarship and debate and philosophy and, you know, what is truth, of course, that opens up a whole can of worms that I fear we will not have time to cover today.
Yeah. This book, Advice to a Young Scientist, I mean, it's not that you're particularly aged at this point, but having gone through some of the ropes and leapt some of the barriers and so on, and indeed, it doesn't need to be advice to a young scientist. It can be advice to a young lawyer, advice to a young philosopher. What have you learned in this sort of path that you think you'd like to pass on? What do you tell students when you're mentoring them?
I tell them to find the thing that they're passionate about, and to, you know, to if they follow the thing that they're passionate about, they'll find the right place for them. So, when I said I really didn't set out intentionally to end up in this field, I mean that. It wasn't a field when I set out in my, you know, path of learning, but I was passionate about learning about these different areas and convinced that there was some way to make them all work together. And I'm fortunate that I'm able to explore that interest and continue to do so as an academic and somebody who's able to, you know, comment on those issues. So I'd say first, follow your passion. For the scientist, which is a slightly different perspective, I'd say don't follow your passion at the exclusion of understanding how it works with the rest of the world. So I want scientists to have a stronger voice, and I want young scientists to recognize that there are social implications of the work that they're doing, and to engage in that social dialogue and to help direct that social dialogue so that the science isn't misconstrued, but is represented not only by, you know, people who are doing bioethics or people who are doing public policy or people in the legal arena, but by the scientists themselves. Have a voice, and use that voice to shape the direction that their scientific research goes, as well as to understand and, you know, participate in those debates.
If you hadn't gone into these areas, I mean, is there anything else that you could conceivably have done as a, I mean, when you say follow your passion, I mean, remember Joseph Campbell and the myth stories that he used to tell people to follow their bliss. I mean, what other bliss might there have been for you?
It's hard to imagine what I would be doing other than what I'm doing right now, but you know, I certainly explored a lot of different options. I think there are a lot of opportunities to understand and to research and to be part of this debate. So I could imagine having worked in governments and worked in, you know, different scientific advisory capacities. I could imagine working in business and working for consulting companies who are working with healthcare companies and biotech companies and things like that. In fact, I did, you know, work at a consulting company for a few years and worked primarily in the areas of biotech and healthcare. I could imagine being a practicing attorney where I am, you know, working on issues, legal issues that touch on some of these concerns and some that don't touch on these concerns. You know, I'm certainly passionate about the law generally and not just at how science intersects with the law. So I could imagine having gone on many different paths, but I'm quite happy that I went the path I did.
But not being a musician or a Sufi dancer or something?
I'd have a hard time being a musician because I think
I'm... giving you a larger range here.
Well, I am passionate about music, I am afraid that no one would ever want to hear me sing. So it certainly couldn't be that direction. Now, you know, could I imagine having been involved in some totally different area? Perhaps, but I think I would feel a real longing to be in the area that I'm in right now.
Now, one question I always like to ask people is to give them an opportunity to set up a dinner party. Mm-hmm. So that they can have a conversation with anybody they would love to ask some questions of, from history or wherever. Can you think of anybody you'd like to have invite to a dinner party?
Oh, I mean, it just depends on what we're having for the dinner party. So, I mean, there are many people that I would love to meet and talk to, and this is where, you know, maybe my other life would...
You can time travel as well. You can time
travel. Well, I imagine that I might actually want to, you know... have many different dinner parties, so I hope I'm not constrained to just one, but I, you know, be super interested in learning about my own ancestry and to invite people from, you know, historical Persian empires to be part of the dinner conversation and understand how that culture evolved. And, you know, from a scientific perspective, there was a tremendous period of scientific progress, and you know, we can look back at a place like Persepolis, right, in Shiraz in Iran, and think, how is it that such a structure came to be built? How is it that something that, you know, with measures using computers to see how they have these carvings in the wall, being able to understand the scientific technology they had and what it was that they meant to represent with that place, I could imagine wanting to talk to artists, so I am a collector of modern art, and I would be fascinated to understand people who were the initiators of modern art and using perception and space and what their idea was, why it was that they wished to move away from realism into understanding perceptions of space and time. So looking at people like Donald Judd or you know, Moreau or Lichtenstein or Andy Warhol, who are each playing with different images that are common to society and trying to present to us that our viewpoints and our concepts of space and time and society generally are ones that, you know, can be looked at through different lenses. So, you know, I could imagine a number of different dinner parties, but each of them would be wanting to try to understand society at the time and understand the visionaries at the time.
You have some scientists there as well?
Well, I think I would certainly have some scientists in the Persian Empire. And yeah, I mean, what would be fun is go back to the American eugenics movements and, you know, talk to the scientists at that time and talk to both people from society as well as scientists and see, you know, what was their view, understand their conception of science, understand how it was that they thought science could influence society, because every account of it suggests that they were very well-intentioned and that they, you know, believed that they were doing what was in the best interest of society generally, and that it simply, the science wasn't as good, and that the intention was one that we judge now as being ill-directed. But, you know, to see how even well-meaning scientists can be led astray would be an interesting conversation to have.
Yeah, I can see this being an interesting party to have Al-Khazen and Al-Ghazali and Hafez with Darwin.
Yes. I mean, could you imagine? Now, so think about Hafez and Rumi, right, together with some modern, you know, contemporary artists, together with people from the American eugenics movement, and, you know, some of the ancient scientists and even more modern scientists. I think it might be nice to have Francis Collins there as part of the conversation as well. So I'd invite you too, Roger.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I could ask some of the questions.
Yes. We might ask some questions of you then. That would be fun.
Part of the enterprise.
Right.
There's in this same issue of, I want to go back to this last one thing, of the Philosopher's Magazine. There's a section in here called My Philosophy, and it's Ziauddin Sardar, who is describes himself as a believing Muslim, but also a skeptical Muslim, in the sense that I believe in asking questions that Muslims would not ask. And he talks about being spiritual. He talks about, we just mentioned some names there of some of the great philosophers, you know, like Al-Ghazali and so on. Since you have some historical connection with that part of the world, do you see, are you optimistic about some sort of resolution of this? And we're going back to the Sam Harris stuff as well here. I mean, here's somebody who says, look, I'm quite happy getting along with having a Muslim background, and yet I feel spiritual, I'm not religious. I mean,
do I think that there will be a resolution between people who are atheists and religious, people who believe in a materialistic world versus a spiritual world, that kind of resolution?
Yeah. Because it is such
I mean, there is a divide and there's a gulf between those areas. And, you know, suppose that you were able, from a scientific perspective, to show that everything was materialistic and, you know, prove materialism to be true. I would guess that wouldn't answer somebody who is quite religious, their view, right? Which is, you know, you can't see it. That's what faith is about. Yeah. And that it's difficult to explain, you know, the way and the order and the universe and things like that simply through science alone. So I think it'll be difficult to truly reconcile those two viewpoints. What I hope is that rather than talking past each other, that we will talk to each other, meaning, you know, every side of this issue will be able to have a common dialogue and find some common ground.
One of the words that came up a lot during the last weekend was this concept of dignity, mm-hmm. And I was just looking again at some papers on this topic. The President's Council on Bioethics produced a book called Human Dignity in Bioethics, and there was testimony taken from various places, and Patricia Churchland and Steve Pinker went along and had, from a scientific and philosophical point of view, issues with the definition of that and what it really meant. Steve actually, Pinker actually ended up writing a piece in the New Republic called The Stupidity of Dignity. Wanted to talk about this in a completely different way. This is the issue, the point I was making before about there are these hallowed words that actually do have a resonance for a great many people, that when they're put under this sort of scientific microscope, if you like, even with a goodwill by people who are saying, look, you really got to try and understand what you're talking about here, unless we can get some sort of a grip on what this actually means, what freight you want this word to carry, then we're talking at loggerheads here. I mean, do you think that this is the sort of topic that this commission should be dealing with?
So I think
introducing it into the public arena, going on with it, or
so I think that the President's Council on Bioethics under the Bush administration was charged with having sort of these kinds of philosophical inquiries, and so I think it's up to the administration for what would be the most useful to them for what they would wish for a commission like that to do. And do I think that these are issues that are right to bring to public discourse and debate? Certainly they are. The very difficult issues which can be challenging to then distill into policy-making decisions. And so it really depends on what you view a body like that doing. If the purpose of a body like that is to raise discussion and raise awareness and to engage the public in a dialogue about these things, then I think it can certainly be a worthwhile and valuable conversation.
Right. What are you optimistic about?
Generally in life, I'm optimistic that Duke is going to win the Final Four.
You could answer that however you wish, but I think I was looking for some sort of
less trite answer.
some sort of metaphysically more charged answer, I suppose.
I'm optimistic that we will continue to make progress in this area, and that. And when I say this area, I mean all of these areas, right? So understanding human nature, understanding the brain, understanding our bodies and how science and society intersect. I'm hopeful that as science progresses, that people will engage in some of the most difficult conversations, which are, how do we want this scientific evidence to be used in the legal system? How do we want scientific progress to occur? Do we have concerns about the ethical limitations of certain types of scientific research? And I'm optimistic that we are up to that challenge, which is to figure out what the course of our own progress will look like, and to be able to direct that progress in a way that respects our values.
I mentioned earlier that this is the 350th anniversary year of the foundation of the Royal Society.
Right.
And I think we've had this conversation before when I mentioned to you that it began in 28th of November 1660 was the official first meeting. Mm-hmm. And they'd all been to a lecture by Christopher Wren on astronomy. People tend to forget that people had these multiple talents in those days, that he was giving a lecture on astronomy. He was an astronomer, but he also, as you know, became a great architect as well. Robert Hooke was an architect.
That seems like actually a nice combination.
Right. Around that time, from about 1600 onwards, there's very much the influence of Francis Bacon.
Yes.
And there's a shift from just believing in the sort of ratiocination of ancient thought to actually doing some experiments. I mean, that's what Bacon was all about. And it's interesting that this whole phrase, which is being used at that time, just starts being used in science, of facts of the matter, and the matter of fact comes from the law. That's where it was originally used.
Right.
And Bacon, of course, was Lord Chancellor of England. So I think, point one, I think this connection between the two is long-standing, and we hope will be enormously fruitful. Now,
I would expand that, right, to say...
Go ahead.
The language has shifted over time, right, which is to say evidence-based research, right? And we use that same word in law as well, right, which is the evidence, right? So we don't just judge people based on our intuitions. We actually require people to present evidence in order to support their perspectives. And, of course, that's a common thread in both fields, right, which is we're looking for evidence of our hypotheses. And so we come into the legal system and say our hypothesis is that this person has committed this crime, and here's the evidence that we have used to try to support this. And likewise in science, we start with a hypothesis and we, you know, ultimately hope to prove our theory. And, you know, there is a commonality and and that helps explain why, in part, you know, law is trying to use scientific evidence to help with decision-making in law, right? We want objective evidence, and likewise in science, we want objective evidence to support our hypotheses. But we have to have a hypothesis, right, in both. So to, you know, kind of reiterate the point that I've made, it doesn't all come from the evidence, right? We have to have some external thinking, decision-making, normative judgments, non-normative judgments, descriptive judgments that we externally impose on these different fields, and then we use the evidence to support it. So it starts by being colored with our own perspective, and we have to understand that at the end of the day, our own perspective has to be weighed against whatever evidence we derive from the legal field or from the scientific field.
There was a report done by the Royal Society in January of this year, New Frontiers in Science Diplomacy, Navigating the Changing Balance of Power. And this is very much an initiative of one of the initiatives of Martin Rees, Lord Rees, President of the Royal Society.
That's an interesting phrase, and isn't it science diplomacy?
Right, but as I look at the, who were the people there, I mean, they included Anne Harrington, who was director of the Committee on International Security and Arms Control, National Academies of Sciences, but also obviously a historian of science here.
So that highlights one issue, right, which is science is not some isolated field. Of course, there is tremendous applications in every area, including international diplomacy, international security.
Chris Llewellyn Smith was there. We have a conversation with him on the Science Network because he's working on this thing, synchrotron light for experimental science and applications in the Middle East, SESAME, set up in Jordan, where he tries to bring together scientists from nations that are all, frankly, at war.
Yeah.
To see if they can actually collaborate on something. So just Nazar Farooqi, Director of Innovation in Canada, people from all over the world, this whole notion of science as a global enterprise.
Yes.
And at the back, they point out that the Royal is working towards to achieve five strategic priorities, and I just want to run them by you, and also this this sense of the global nature of science. One, invest in future scientific leaders and in innovation. Two, influence policy making with the best scientific advice. Invigorate science and mathematics education. Increase access to the best science internationally. And inspire an interest in the joy, wonder, and excitement of scientific discovery.
Those sound all like promising and appropriate.
Pretty good menu, isn't it?
Yes.
So you will be doing your best, since you're working in all those areas with the diplomacy and so on, I assume, to implement those five I's as we move forward.
Sound like good ones to live by, so yeah.
And then we have to do the next Beyond Belief, which we've discussed already.
Indeed. I think maybe moral thought and decision making should play a preeminent role in it.
All right, well, I look forward to our next conversation. Nita Varahani, thanks very much.
Thank you, Roger.